celebrating a state championship. Again, this collective bargaining agreement provides space for progress. We have a evaluation system in the Chicago Public Schools that has deprivileged both Black children and Black teachers of a very well-rounded experience. What we've done is marginalize those impacts and created pathways to get more Black teachers into the system. While corporations like Target are walking away from embracing Black workers and Black employees, we are providing pathways to support more of them.
And could you talk about the difficulty of the negotiations? Clearly, this was an unusual situation because the current mayor, Brandon Johnson, used to be an organizer with your union. So the union striking against this mayor who was so close to them would have been a difficult situation. How were you able to maneuver with the negotiations with the Chicago Public Schools and the mayor's office?
The power of our solidarity has been most vividly illustrated in our ability to strike. Karen Lewis led one in 2012 that was perhaps one of the most galvanizing moments of our nation's labor history. But beyond that, what we've done is that we've done a few things. We've resisted the impacts of privatization and created spaces through the strike, through negotiating, through the coalition space to create power, power that enables us to do a lot of things. Yes, we can fight. We do that very well. And it's that fight, the equity that we build in that struggle that has enabled this opportunity to push for something that has been more transformative. We've changed and enshrined in this contract a budgeting system that creates equity, that is embedded in making sure that children who go to school on the south and the west sides of the city, that their budgets are prioritized in a repertory manner. That is in this contract. That's not just built through the negotiating table. That's built through community coalition. That is built through supporting hunger strikes. That is built through taking it to the picket line. It is built through bold, unapologetic love for our city's children.
I was wondering if you could comment on Karen Lewis. You wrote the afterword to the new memoir by the former CTU president, Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis, the book titled I Didn't Come Here to Lie, My Life and Education. It's also got a foreword by Angela Davis. Can you talk about her life and legacy as a transformative leader and what lessons you think are key to draw upon now?
That is a wonderful question. Thank you. Karen Lewis is the blueprint for the type of leadership that we need in this very moment. Karen Lewis took the helm of the Chicago Teachers Union when Rahm Emanuel was the mayor of this city, a mayor that used the public good for the rich. In fact, he and Elon piled around here in Chicago. We had a mayor that foreclosed on public education by shutting down 50 schools on Black children on the south and west sides of the city. We had a mayor who covered up the murder of a Black teenager in the city. We faced a very well-funded neoliberal establishment that was hell-bent on marginalizing everything that we needed to have life and life more abundantly. Karen Lewis organized. She found her confederates and the community and organizations like the Kenwood Oakland and people like G2 Brown and Northside Action for Justice and built a movement that was based on giving Chicagoans what they deserve. Because if you give Chicagoans what they deserve, the children of this city are rooted and anchored in that. And so what I would say in this moment is that Karen Lewis was fearless. Karen Lewis looked at power and laughed. Karen Lewis created space for coalition. And Karen Lewis led with humility and with a fearlessness of love, care, and legacy.
Stacey Davis Gates, thanks so much for being with us, president of the Chicago Teachers Union, joining us from Chicago. when we come back, an update on Burma's massive earthquake. Over, well, thousands have died. Aid groups say there's still enormous need. Meanwhile, with the gutting of USAID, where's the United States in helping join with other countries around the world? Stay with us. To the Sun by Kaina. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Burma, also known as Myanmar, where the death toll from Friday's 7.7 magnitude earthquake has now topped 3,000, including 50 children who were killed when their preschool collapsed. In neighboring Thailand, where at least 21 people have been killed, more than 70 are believed to still be trapped under the rubble. A video filmed by a teenage girl in Burma Saturday shows her ordeal as she was trapped with her sister and grandma in the wreckage of their apartment building in Mandalay, the epicenter of the quake. One of the girls can be seen banging on the rubble, crying out for help with her grandmother's face covered in blood.
Hello, somebody there? We are stuck in here. Please help us. I beg you, please pull us out.
The girls and their grandmother were later rescued, but the civil war that's raged since the 2021 military coup has complicated efforts to allow aid to reach all those affected by the quake. As rebel groups accuse the junta of conducting airstrikes even after the earthquake, Amnesty International said the military junta needs to urgently allow humanitarian groups unimpeded access to all areas of Burma. China, Russia, India, Vietnam, and Thailand all quickly sent rescue teams and emergency aid. The Trump administration's dismantling of USAID has slowed the U.S. response. A day the earthquake struck, the administration said it was firing nearly all remaining USAID personnel and closing its foreign missions. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce confirmed that a three-person assessment team from USAID will travel to Burma this week.
The United States will provide up to $2 million through Burma-based humanitarian assistance organizations to support earthquake-affected communities as an immediate response to the March 28th earthquake. A U.S. aid team of humanitarian experts based in the region are traveling to Burma now to identify the people's most pressing needs.
For more, we're joined by Mung Zarni, Burmese dissident, human rights activist, scholar of genocide, co-founder of Forces of Renewal for Southeast Asia, or FORSI, a grassroots network of pro-democracy scholars and human rights activists across Southeast Asia. He's from Mandalay, the epicenter of the earthquake in Burma's second largest city. Zarni, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the situation.
Well, it is really a triple whammy, Amy. The coup came on the heel of COVID-19. The country was reeling from the lack of a serious healthcare infrastructure and massive debt tolls and spread of COVID. And then the coup triggered this civil war, which came on top of a low-intensity anti-junta resistance movement that had been going on for 60 to 70 years, depending on the ethnic regions. And then on top of that, in the fourth year of the civil war, we were hit by earthquake. And the earthquake hit the, importantly, the heartland of Burmese Buddhist majority, the dry zone, including the capital of the junta. So this is really a triple whammy.
And Zarni, how has the continuing civil war and the military checkpoints all around the country affected the ability of search and rescue operations to get to people trapped under the rubble?
Well, three things affect negatively search and rescue missions by even the locals. Number one is the infrastructural damage to freeway, highways, and local lanes that have hampered movement of, the rescue teams or goods and services to the affected areas. The Zagain and Mandalay are two major cities, and then the capital, Naypyi Taw. And then the second is the military junta is rightly paranoid for its survival because it's losing massive territorial control across the country. So the military junta step up, obstacles. They're putting up obstacles for, movements of people, particularly at nighttime. And then, the continuing aerial bombardment in areas that the junta has lost control. And so, on top of the earthquake, the military junta is bombing, large villages, towns, and cities in different parts of the country. And then there are also groups like Arakan Army that is also accused of committing atrocity crimes against Rohingya in Western Myanmar, are taking advantage of the situation and attacking some of the junta outposts. And so it's a really demoralizing and very, very dark scenario we are looking at. There is no state as such. There is not a single actor in Burma that can be considered representative of Myanmar as a state. And, the civil society has been largely very much weakened by decades of civil war, a political repression, massive poverty, mismanagement, corruption. All of that have compounded the society's effort to come to rescue.
Also, you are from Mandalay, Burma's second largest city. What is the situation there, the epicenter of the earthquake?
Well, we are about, we are across the river Irrawaddy from the epic center, which is near another dry zone city called Zagain. And people are very afraid of tremors or aftershocks. And these aftershocks seem to be taking place, daily and nightly. So a lot of people are sleeping on the streets in tents under 100 degree Fahrenheit scorching heat. And then there are uncountable number of people buried and I presume crushed under the rubble. So the smell coming from the corpses seem to be like really, really strong. Mandalay is about two or three million population. And, more than 50% of the city structures have been destroyed. And then the Zagain, our neighbor city across the river, 90% of the Zagain is completely crushed, and then the aid is not reaching there.
Zarni.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about aid and international aid. You know what's going on in this country. You were a student at the University of Wisconsin. You have China, Russia, India quickly sending emergency teams. And a meager three-person team from the U.S. hasn't even arrived here yet. On Friday, some workers at USAID's Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance received layoff emails while they were preparing to respond to the earthquake. What are you calling for when it comes to international aid from the United States, but also from all over the world?
A penny, type of humanitarian assistance from any quarter of the world that wishes to help. The military, to my initial excitement, has said they would receive any international assistance from any country, whether hostile to the junta or not. So I was quite excited to hear that statement from the junta head May online. But I think, like, you know, aside from the, how the military responds to the international offer of assistance, I think we're not even talking about the USAID help or the American taxpayers' money. There is $1 billion U.S. dollar frozen as a result of the February 2021 military coup by the Biden administration. That money, if there is any time that is, good for that money to be unfrozen, it's now. You know, I understand that, like, you know, the Biden and Trump administration did not or do not want to release that money and then, like, you know, put fuel into the raging civil war. But that money should be set up internationally and handled by an international body. $1 billion for earthquake rescue and relief fund. That is something that the Trump administration and the Congress should seriously consider. This is the darkest hour of need for the Myanmar people. Forget the regime, forget the resistance, forget the civil war. We need to get some kind of humanitarian ceasefire for, like, you know, say 100 days by every actor involved in the conflict and get the rescue and reconstruction begin.
Mong Zarni, we want to thank you so much for being with us. We will continue to cover this disaster, a 7.7 magnitude earthquake in Burma, the epicenter, your home city of Mandalay. The numbers of dead are 3,000 and counting. Mong Zarni is a Burmese dissident, human rights activist, and scholar of genocide. Up next, we look at the alarming rise in censorship on U.S. campuses. We speak with a professor, a former international head of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, after NYU canceled her presentation. She was talking, among other things, mentioning Gaza and also USAID. Stay with us.
Looking out my window, all I see is pain. I'm not really sure how we all turn to rain. All I wanna do is pray with you.
We spend so much time on being alone. I just really want you to find your way home. I'm sure you need it now. That you need it now.
And I know that you're scared, but together we'll make it through.
We could be each other's heroes. We could be each other's heroes.
And all I wanna do is to be with you. Looking at the photos that I can't forget.
Each Other's Heroes by Amun and Las Meling. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a look at the alarming rise in censorship on university campuses across the United States. Last month, New York University abruptly canceled a presentation by the former international head of Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, because some of her slides could be viewed as, quote, anti-governmental. Dr. Joanne Liu, a Canadian pediatric emergency medicine physician, a professor of clinical medicine at McGill University, and the former international president of Doctors Without Borders, was scheduled to speak at NYU, her alma mater, in March. She'd been invited over a year ago to discuss the challenges of humanitarian crises. But the night before her speech, NYU's vice chair of the education department called her to express concern over the content of some of her slides about casualties in Gaza and cuts at the U.S. Agency for International Development. She offered to make edits, but 3 hours later, she was told her presentation was canceled. In an op-ed in a French newspaper describing how elite universities are in the crosshairs of presidential cuts, Dr. Liu said she was astonished by the institution's posture of preemptive over obedience. Dr. Joanne Liu joins us now from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain exactly what happened, Dr. Liu.
Good morning. Yes, sure. So, as you said, I was invited several months ahead, and it's my alma mater. It was the first time they were inviting me since I graduated in the 90s. So you have to understand that for me, it was a moment of rejoice and happiness of being invited back. And so the title of the presentation was Challenges in Humanitarian Crisis. And I was covering what have happened over the last year because things have changed. This is a normal and regular lecture that I gave, but I always update it on a regular basis. So basically, I went to New York, and then I had submitted my presentation on the platform. And then as soon as I arrived, because I was living at a friend's house, he just said, by working in the ER at NYU, he said, by the way, the administration wants to talk to you. And then I ended up talking with the lady from the education, the vice chair. And she said, well, listen, what do you have to say about your presentation? I said, not much, but I think you have concerns. You want to share them with me? And then she tells me that there was a slide that she thought that could be troubling the audience, and it could be perceived anti-Semitic because I was showing the number of casualties in conflict zones in aid worker. And it is an extract from the aid workers security database. And of course, there is a fair amount of casualty in Gaza, knowing what is happening right now, but in other countries as well, like Sudan, like South Sudan and Ukraine. In addition to that, she said, well, we think that it could possibly be perceived as well as anti-governmental. The way you talk about the U.S. cut, the picture of Zelensky and Trump. So I let her speak and I said, okay. I said, what do you want to do about that? Do you want to offer me a suggestion where I could either change the presentation, nuances, how I'm going to articulate things? You know what? I'm chill. I'm really chill. I'm flexible. I want this to be a good moment. And then she hesitated. And then I said, okay. And then a few minutes after, I said, let me offer those three slides I would remove. As long as I can keep the key overarching message, I'm fine. I can manage that. And she said, okay, listen, I'll get back to you in a few hours. And basically, 3 hours later, I got a phone call. And the lady was really, I would say that she was really sad. Anyway, I said, I sent some sadness. And she said, listen, I'm very sorry. But we've been talking for the last 3 hours. And I have to inform you that we have decided to cancel your conference.
And Dr. Liu, you were for 6 years the president of Doctors Without Borders, one of the most prestigious medical groups in the world. Have you ever had a talk canceled before?
Actually, when a talk is canceled, it's because I'm canceling it, but not the other way around. It did happen because for security circumstances or changes in, I could not attend, but it happened really rarely. It was from my side.
And were you, your reaction to when they told you it was canceled?
So my reaction was, I was stunned. It was not part of my scenario. I'm someone who always planned for worst case scenario, but I could not imagine that case scenario because these are my friends. And it was a moment of being united. We haven't seen each other for a while. And they send me regularly, I would say, email telling me how excited they were. They told me some of our staff, I've seen your presentation a few years ago. They said you brought tears to their eyes because the content is so moving. We are so excited. So I just thought that we would manage to find, I would say, a middle ground in all that. So, yes, it's completely stunned and, of course, disappointed.
So in your presentation, as you mentioned, you included a table from the Aid Worker Security Database that shows one of the places with the highest humanitarian casualties last year was the Gaza Strip. You were told you could be perceived as anti-Semitic if you talked about this, and also if you talked about USAID perceived as anti-governmental. Respond to both, Dr. Liu, and what your international humanitarian work is all about.
Well, with respect to that slide, it was not specifically, I would say, on Gaza. It was the compilation of number of casualties in conflict zone, in aid worker community. And this is what I was trying to explain to the person, because I just said, yes, this is the reason why we don't see casualty on the other side, because it's about aid worker. For the cut on USAID, you just covered it, you know, when the disaster is happening in Myanmar in your show earlier, it's massive. It's massive. The generosity of US over the last years, if not decades, have been massive. They were covering the overseas developmental aid, you know, up to 30% in terms of humanitarian aid. Now, according to the numbers, it's something between 40 to 45% on a yearly basis. So, of course, when you do that abruptly, there's going to be consequences. And so when you look at the figure, one of the things I was bringing forward is how it's going to impact the HIV/AIDS program, where actually one of the most saving programs is an American program, is PEPFAR, is the presidential program to fight HIV/AIDS. And people expect there's going to be several hundred of thousands of kids who might die, and patients. And there's going to be a rise in terms of numbers, because mothers who are HIV positive will not have access to antiretroviral medicine and will transmit the infection to their child during birth. So it's massive, the impact. And I was just talking, because my presentation basically is on three pillars. It talks about ultra track attention when a crisis happened, the security now in a conflict zone and crisis time, and then the third pillar was on funding.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but there was also news that USAID is moving to end funding for Gavi, the Global Vaccine Alliance, that provides life-saving vaccines for millions of poor children around the world. Your response?
Yes, I think it's going to be a disaster, of course. But I would like, before we end the show, the reason why I wrote this letter is the fact that I truly and strongly believe that university are the temple of knowledge, but as well of plurality of ideas. And if we do not allow that, we are basically killing the essence of what university is about. It's about having people to be able to express different point of view in a safety environment, where as well students can be exposed to it and make up their mind. That is what is necessary, and that is what makes a university, even a country, stronger, by plurality of ideas.
We do have 20 seconds. You are an alum of NYU. In this 20 seconds, what do you think the students lost in not hearing your speech?
Well, I think they lost the fact of getting a sort of a different point of view of someone who's been, I would say, a field aid worker. So basically, I went from being on ground zero to the leadership role, and I was giving basically the whole spectrum of what it means doing aid work nowadays.
Dr. Joanne Liu, we thank you so much for being with us. Canadian pediatric emergency medicine physician, associate professor of medicine at University of Montreal, professor of clinical medicine at McGill University, and former head of Doctors Without Borders.
Hi, I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the host of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday.
Tune in to hear meaningful conversations exploring all ideas through a sociological lens.
DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.